Good morning, everybody. I want to welcome everybody to the Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development Finance and Policy Committee here for March 4th, 2026. And I want to welcome everybody here. Today's agenda is one subject area. We're going to talk a lot about the Promise Act that was passed in 2023, sort of the process of what that is. From the deed office, we'll be hearing from them, from Deputy Commissioner McKinnon. We'll be hearing from our sort of the partners of the program, too, that helped deploy the dollars that were allocated back in 2023. And then we'll also open it up for just questions. There's been some indicators that we want to make sure that we're getting it right, because the money is still literally going out. We want to make sure we're getting it right as more rounds are opened and moving forward. So with that, again, we'll welcome everybody this morning. So after calling the meeting to order, I want to say that Vice Chair Mecklen, have you had a chance to review the minutes of March 3rd?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I move the minutes.
Minutes are moved from yesterday, March 3rd. Any questions, concerns? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are passed. I'd like to welcome Mr. McKinnon to the table, to the testifying table, if you will, or anybody else who's with your team. Appreciate that. I wanted to say sort of to the public, we got our materials a little bit late for some of these today, so not everything was posted on time that we normally do, but the packets have been delivered today. Thank you, folks, for doing that. Mr. McKinnon, welcome to the committee. I think back in the day, you were the interim commissioner of DEED, too, and this was kind of rolling through. There's a lot going on, and so you're the right guy to have here today. So thank you very much, Deputy Commissioner. Welcome, and introduce yourself and proceed. I'll just set this up a little bit more. Sorry. Just help us with this, because we didn't have a really good vetted conversation about this in the Minnesota House back in 2023. This was an unusual pathway, and we'll talk a little bit about that. So help us understand kind of how we got here, how it's going, so we can understand this program that is, again, as I mentioned earlier, still deploying a lot of dollars in greater Minnesota, in the metro. So go ahead, Mr. McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members. My name is Kevin McKinnon. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Economic Development, and Chair Baker is correct. There was a period of 4 or 5 months in early 2023, late 22 and early 23, where I was the temporary commissioner before our current commissioner, Verilek, joined our organization. So today, just a quick Promise Act update. The agenda is here. I will go through some of the legislative background. I'll talk about implementation and where we are, how much money has been spent, et cetera. And then I'll talk a little bit about roles and risk mitigation as we work through this program. So as far as the establishment of this program, essentially, as the chair mentioned, in 2023, this was established. And subsequently, in 2024 and in 2025, it has been amended with different amendments to the program that the legislature has made. Essentially, when created, it was a financial relief and assistance program for businesses that were left behind by previous financial programs, essentially resulting from the pandemic. You can see on the slide some of the barriers that were called out in the law for those businesses that would be eligible. There is $94 million of assistance that is available to the businesses. We can talk about, I'll describe what the rest of the budget looks like as it relates to this program. But essentially, there is $94 million available in financial assistance. You can also see the broad uses of the funds that the eligible businesses were able to use that money for. So promise grant allocations, so these are the monies that essentially have been appropriated to the Promise Act in 2023, in 2024, and in 2025. So there's been subsequent appropriations by the legislature to this program. Essentially, $16 million of this is for the Minnesota Initiative Foundations. That's the six regions that serve outside of the Twin Cities metro, and who most of you are probably familiar with and do work in your communities. $86 million was allocated to the Neighborhood Development Center, and very specifically, the legislature called out a number of different corridors, neighborhoods within North Minneapolis, South Minneapolis, St. Paul, and then subsequently also has made areas of the seven county suburbs also available for the program. You can also see of the $103 million or so that partners may retain up to 5% for administration of the program, which helps them on the ground in implementing the program. They also had 3% for technical assistance. So essentially, the people who are applying for the program may go to these organizations to get assistance in applying for the program, whether that might be a language barrier, maybe it's assembling the tax returns, et cetera, that are needed. But nonetheless, these organizations were provided these resources for that technical assistance. And then you can see that DEED has a portion for administration as well, about $237,000 a year over the four-year period. Eligibility and preference requirements in law. I think you can obviously see some of the eligibility that is baked into the law. I think what's important here for me to point out is that businesses must have had revenues of less than $750,000 in the prior year before applying in annual revenue to be eligible for the program. That provision was actually changed, I believe, in 2024. Originally, it called out 2021 taxes as the base year. Subsequently, I think it was in 2024, the legislature changed that to make it the prior year. And so knowing that the program was going to continue, knowing that the program was going to continue, they made that change. Also, another change that the legislature made, and this is new for round two, which I'll talk about these rounds in a minute. The legislature put in a provision that if you are a business and you are using your home address, you must have filed the home office deduction on your taxes to be eligible. And so that has been implemented into round two that we are currently in. I should also note that in the law there is preferences for our partners and us to make decisions. One is that the businesses must demonstrate financial hardship, and part of that is based on those barriers that were indicated in the law. But secondly, did not receive previous assistance of more than $10,000 from other state financial assistance programs. And if you recall, I just mentioned the COVID relief or the pandemic issues that were happening. During the pandemic, we did give $10,000 COVID relief grants, and that's sort of the basis for why this program was included those preferences. Award amounts. The legislature also determined the amount of the grants that the businesses were eligible for based upon their revenues in the previous year. As you can see on the slide, again, $750,000 was the maximum revenue that a business could have. There was also a money reserved for businesses with less than $100,000 in revenue. Generally, amounts through this first round have indicated that it's generally in the 10% of a business's revenue over the year is essentially what the grant has amounted to. in the metro area and in greater Minnesota through the foundations. It's a little larger, maybe 15% to 17% of a business's revenue from the prior year. I will just point out at this point the average grant amount is $18,000 for these small businesses. So on to the implementation side of this program. So I'll just give you a little history of the timeline here. It took us about 9 months in working with our partners to assemble what the actual program would look like, what it would be, and try to put things in place with those partners. Shortly after that, some of our partners came out with their round one and were able to start accepting applications and were able to begin making awards probably as early as July of 2024 in that time frame. Round one that, as I mentioned, just opened, officially closed on July of 2025. So in other words, all applications were accepted, reviewed, and applicants were selected by that time. Subsequently, round two opened immediately thereafter, sometime in August of 2025. There are some gaps in some of this, just so as the legislature changes the program, we have to make changes with our grantees, and then our grantees have to implement those changes as they run this program. So partners and service area, as I mentioned, our partners do serve in greater Minnesota through the Ms. McKnight Initiative Foundations, do serve every part of the rural area through the coverage that their foundations have. And again, I'll point out in the Twin Cities Metro, and this is for the grant program only, in the Twin Cities Metro, the Neighborhood Development Center is our grantee. So where are we in the awarding of this money? So the story on this slide is we are about 24% of the way through, or $22 million has been awarded to 1,235 businesses as of maybe it was last week or whenever this data was produced. You can see on the slide essentially that we actually have one of our foundations is all the way through their program. Others are still in the process of getting it out. Others are about 50% of the way through. I think what I'd like to point out here is the total allocation, as I mentioned, is $103 million. You can see how it breaks down from administration to those organizations to do the work, how it breaks down from a technical assistance perspective, and then the amount of grants that are available. The green column obviously indicates how much has been awarded, and so that also would give you an indication of what is left in this program, $72 million or something like that at this time. And, of course, the 1,200 businesses that were awarded by the regions in which they were awarded. The next slide here is just a minute on the Promise Act loans. So at the same time this grant program was created, there was also a loan program created that essentially followed the same guidelines around who's eligible, the barriers to access to resources, et cetera, for this loan program. There was $30 million appropriated for this, so it actually makes the total appropriation for the program somewhere in the neighborhood of $130 million between the loan program and the grant program. This too has been amended in past sessions. It has been changed since 2023. The revenue threshold for a business was increased, I believe, from $1 million in the initial law to now $1.5 million in annual revenue based on the previous year's taxable or revenue that's reported through their taxes. And another change that was made, I'm not sure if it was 24 or 25, allowed these organizations to keep the repayments that that they were provided from making these loans to the businesses. So there's $30 million total for this program, and you can see on the chart how it was allocated. In the metropolitan area, in the Twin Cities area, this is done through the Metropolitan Economic Development Association, who will do the loans for eligible businesses. And in Greater Minnesota, it's of course the very same foundations who do this. All of these organizations have been lending partners of ours for a long time, as long as I've been around, and so that was one of the requirements, is that they had to have a revolving loan fund essentially operating. As you can see on the chart, there is about they're about a third of the way through these loans, so about $9.5 million has been lent at this point. So there's roughly about $20 million that is still in the works, and these partners continue to work with businesses in their regions to help them get qualified and or execute these loans. So moving on to a bit on the roles and the risk mitigation that that we undertook as we tried to put this program together initially, and then over the course of the last couple of years as laws have changed, as things have become more clear about how the program has worked. I thought it might be helpful just to give you a sense of what a business does and the steps that it takes in and what our organizations do when a business applies to them. Because as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the businesses have either worked with the organizations who are providing technical assistance or some of the partners who have been providing technical assistance. But nonetheless, the businesses do submit all of this information to the partners. They do not submit this to DEED. So all the application intake and that work is done at the partner level, who are our grantees, the seven entities that I've been showing here, the Initiative Foundations and NDC and MEDA. But in order to apply for this program, you have to submit a variety of documentation, as you would expect. That includes 2 to 3 years of tax documentation, other source documentation like photo IDs, social security numbers, employment identification numbers, leases on the property that the business leases, utility bills, et cetera, to verify that they meet the eligibility, that they're located in the geographic area, and that's sort of a first step or first cut as they look at this. Then they must complete an application to the partner organization, essentially attesting as to what they, how they were impacted, what they will do with the funds, and then upload all of this information to a secure portal that is provided to all of these organizations. Once the business meets initial eligibility checks, that again are, it's all conducted at the partner level. Then they proceed to the identity and documentation verification process. So what does that mean? You know, I'll just give you an example. In the Metro, NDC uses the same identification tool that banks use. When banks make loans, they verify the identity of the individual and learn a little bit more about their backgrounds, et cetera. And they provide that documentation. The MIFs, the Initiative Foundations, also have various ways that they verify the identity of the individual who is assigned to this. And I think that's important also, is that for every business that we're really dealing with here, they're all it is all by individuals. So there are individuals tied to all of these businesses. If selected and verified as eligible by the partner organization, the partner organization enters into a contract essentially with that business, and that's between our partner organization and the business. Once that's complete, it is all sent to deed, and not only the initial application and the source documentation, but all of this information is sent to deed, and deed will conduct randomized audits of the determinations that the organization has made. So we test their ability to ensure that all of these pieces are covered as they make these determinations. Once that happens, and once if there's any issues that need to be resolved between the partner organization and deed relative to one or multiple of the applications that might go back and forth, then we would officially approve it, and funds would then be dispersed through a request for payment that the partner organization makes to us. We then provide that funding to the organization. The organization, the partnering organization, then disperses the money to the business. Essentially, you know, part of the contracts here, these businesses have to maintain records and receipts, etc., of the things that they used this money for, and at any time, we all reserve the right to go in and audit any of them, both ourselves and our partner organizations through these contracts. Our contract with our partner organizations and our partner organizations' contracts with the businesses. So again, just recapping some of the roles and oversight here. Deed, my staff that are involved in this, are in constant communication with our grantees, which are the seven partners that I've listed, including and up to biweekly meetings, essentially, that we have with the organizations. They meet as a group periodically as well to discuss common issues and things across all of the entities. But nonetheless, this group and the interaction between deed and our partners is much higher than it would be relative to the other programs that we run through deed. So as I mentioned, through the pre-application process, our partners are tasked with providing outreach on the program, making people aware of it. They are tasked with providing that technical assistance. Deed's role, as I mentioned, in setting all of this up was to develop those some of the guidelines, work with the organizations, create the templates, and certainly some of the monitoring activities that we have with our organizations. The application and evaluation process, as I mentioned, our partners are the ones that receive the applications, and to date there is almost 7,000 of those applications, so our partners have been busy sorting through those and determining the identifications and the business information, et cetera, to make some of these eligibility determinations. We obviously provide some audits of this source documentation. When it comes to awards and disbursements, as I mentioned, they submit these determinations to us, and once funds are received from us, then it's dispersed on to the business. And deed has a role there as well. And then post-award, our partners, and they can probably talk more about this, but they do things like survey the awardees. They collect stories of how they've used the funding. They evaluate performance. And as I mentioned earlier, both our partners and DEED reserve the right to audit any of these folks at any time after that. So, Mr. Chair, that concludes my comments, and I'm not sure if there's questions now or there will be others, but I would, before I close, would just say I believe there is a legislative report that is due to you on March 15th that is in the works and will also be on your way, And I would just say we encourage, obviously, continued dialogue on this program and are happy to work as we have the last couple of years on making enhancements to it. So thank you, Mr. Chair. And
thank you. Mr. McKinnon, thank you very much for your overview of this at this point. My plan is to hold member questions right now because we'll have Mr. McKinnon come back up after the our partners that were part of this program to sort of explain their process. They were the ones, I think, really close to the ground helping businesses. I wanted to kind of hear their stories about round two, round one, round two, and how they've been seeing the improvements or the changes to the criteria as well. So thank you, and again, we'll have you back up in a few minutes. So what I'd like to do now is invite up we have three testimony folks that are here in person. I'll have all three of them come up at this point. Shahir Ahmad from the Promise Act grant from the neighborhood NDCs. Also, Adrian Roddick from Meta will be coming up too and talk a little bit about the loan program. And then Scott Marcourt is our president and CEO of the Southwest Initiative Foundation. We also have Greg Wegner and Zach Tabbitt online, and they can join us, but I will call on them so we don't get too many people talking at one time. We'll sort of call on them after a couple of minutes when these are done. And two members, just to kind of, you know, look ahead at our schedule today, I'm trying to wrap up all this testimony with the next five. So we've got a good 45 minutes or so for Q&A if we need to have that. So to our testifiers, thank you for coming in. If each one of you want to take kind of like 5 to 8 minutes, and then we'll kind of move along to the next one, and then I'll flip up to the folks online, and then you can be standing here for questions as well. And then, again, we'll bring up the department as well. That's kind of my plan today. So welcome. Let's go ahead and get started here. If Mr. Ahmad, you would start the testimony today. Please introduce yourself and tell us, again, the experience of how the Promise Act has worked for your organization.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Shahir Ahmad, Vice President of Business Services with Neighborhood Development Center. It is an honor, and members, thank you for this opportunity to come before you. It is an honor that we have been asked to administer this program by the state and legislators, and so we do not take that lightly. Thank you for this time. As Mr. McKinnon mentioned, in 2023, the legislation was passed to implement this program, and that was when our organization was asked to provide this service. Members, you should have a handout that looks like this. I will be going through this form. These are the questions, or these are the preparation for the presentation. There's a timeline, if I may, Chair, walk through briefly for the members so that they understand the experience that not only the applicants experienced as they were applying for the program, but also our administration of the program. So as I mentioned, the contract between DEED and Neighborhood Development Center was in 2023. Then we took about 9 months to build out the platform. As you can imagine, to administer a program of this size, we needed to have the right technology in place, and so it took us quite a bit of time to get that technology, the automations stood up to be ready to administer this program. And so that took us between January of 2024 to May of 2024. In June of 2024, we were able to actually launch the portal, and that portal window for applicants to apply lasted between June 3rd and June 30th. So for about just under 30 days, applicants had the opportunity to apply in round one. In July of August, between July and August of 2024, we began reviewing applications, which we called Stage 1. We had over 3,000 applications at that time. So if you can imagine, within 30 or so or less days, we received over 3,000 applications to review. We began that review between July and August of 2024. Part of that process, and not to get too granular here, sir, Mr. Chair, but part of that process was to have a random selection process. As you can imagine, these funds were very competitive, and so we wanted to ensure that we could, in a fair way, process the applications. As the year continued in our timeline, August of 2024, as Mr. McKinnon from DEED mentioned, we had provided data that we were gathering from the reviews of these applications. And as we shared that data, we were asked to pause so that legislators and DEED could work through interpretation and intent of the law. So that happened during August of 2024. We were then continue processing and reviewing applications, but not to award applications as of yet. In October 2024 to January 2025, we were then allowed to disperse those grants for those early applications that were approved. And then that takes me to January of 2025 to June of 2025. We were then being able to disperse grants in the tune of, we had over 651 approved applications from the 3,000 applications that were reviewed, and that was just about under $9 million. Coming to a little more recent time, in July of 2025, as Mr. McKinnon mentioned, the laws had changed in the program, so we needed time to take those adjustments from the law and tweak the program, the technology and our processes, and receive new guidance from DEED. So that was all of July of 2025. And a bit of August, we did some beta testing of that new new updates to the technology based on the new additions to the law. Then in September of 2025, we launched round two. And our goal for, we are currently in that round of round two for Minneapolis-St. Paul program. And our goal for this round two is to disperse up to the $50 million, which is a lion's share of what's remaining for the grants. And one last note on timeline from NDC is that we have also been tasked to disperse $3 million into the 7-county metro area. We have begun those conversations with economic department agencies in those areas, and we are beginning to develop the technology to deploy those $3 million into the 7-county area. We are just waiting for our guidance from DEED on a few different technicalities to ensure that we can stand that program up. If I can, I would like to take you to, we unfortunately didn't do page numbers, but I'd like to take you to the application process just to dig a little deeper into what the applicants experience in the process that happens a little further than Mr. McKinnon had mentioned. This is about an 11-step process. In the beginning, applicants are required to begin their application with an email confirmation. As you can imagine, entrepreneurs have maybe several different emails that they may use. This was very important for us to get this to ensure that we could process and identify applicants based on one email address. That did cause some of our ripples in processing when applicants had multiple emails. The next step there that you see is stage one, which is the eligibility confirmation, ensuring that that the applicant meets the criteria that has been placed in law. Stage two then is where if the applicant satisfies that eligibility criteria, then they are invited to upload their documents. Mr. McKinnon did mention some of those documents. I'll unpack that in just a moment. And then at that point, our team begins to review. If you see step four there, they begin to review and evaluate those applications. We, as you can imagine, some of these entrepreneurs or these applicants may not have all of the right documentation, or they may need, or we may not be able to verify some of that documentation. So there may be some back and forth between us and the applicant in order for it to satisfy the eligibility criteria that's required by law. And that's what is illustrated in step number four. And then once we, if the applicant has satisfied stages one and stages two, then they are invited to stage three, which is where they will be uploading their identification. As Mr. McKinnon mentioned, we do use the Plaid verification software to verify their identification. They will also at that time be invited to upload their banking information so that we can ensure that the funds are going to go to a legitimate bank. And then steps six through eight are our team will be evaluating, processing, and ensuring applicants do meet the eligibility criteria. We then, in step nine, that is when we send those documents to DEED for further and final verification. Once those final verifications have been met, as Mr. McKinnon mentioned, those grant awardees' dollars are then passed through NDC to those applicants. Some of the documentation, if I may, Chair, I'm not sure how I'm doing on time, but some of the...
About three minutes left.
3 minutes, yes, sir. Some of the required documents that the applicants are required to submit are completed taxes, for example, valid state or governmental identification, proof of operating address, and which is within the eligibility geography, voided check of a bank, W-9s. They do sign two different agreements or contracts that Mr. McKinnon mentioned, a full grant agreement, also a certificate of grant recipient. And finally, if it is applicable, they satisfy or are active on the Secretary of State. I'd like to, in my final time, talk a little bit about grant usage. As the law states, these grants may be used for working capital. We have, in your handout, you have a little pie there that indicates a lot of the how the applicants determined or declared how they would use the grants. And just to get kind of straight to the numbers here, 28% of the applicants will be using or have used their grants for payroll. Equipment, 26%, and equipment is also would be potentially representation of inventory that they may need for their business, utilities, 8%, as well as rent, another 23%. Those are my main comments that I'd like to share, Chair, and I will yield.
Thank you, and I had a quick question on your presentation here.
Yes, sir.
You had listed in your presentation here the successful fraud detection.
Yes.
And I didn't want to push you through that too much.
Yes.
But it's an important part of today's discussion about what you were able to do and identify because of your work in the field for a number of years. And you had a lot of applications that never made it through the final round, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And you are identifying suspected document alterations. Can you explain... When you received, let's say it's a tax form, if it's duplicate information, spend a little bit of time on this about how your organization kind of dealt with that. What did you do with those suspected forms that didn't look legit? And what did you do with them in your operation?
Yes, Mr. Chair. These cases demonstrate that our fraud prevention measures are working as intended and that our team is actively protecting the integrity of the program. So, for instance, to your question, Chair, there we did experience misrepresentation of business identification. So, for example, there were some applicants who would impersonate a chain of restaurant and would apply on behalf of that restaurant. And we knew that that was just not very suspicious and unverifiable. And that was in round one. We had 12 instances of that in round one. In round two, we had over 22 instances where applications were unverifiable. Many shared tax identification or the identification of their tax documents and forms where there were inconsistencies. And so you can imagine when you, not sure how many of you have looked at your taxes or tax forms recently, but if you, there's very clear that the fonts, the inconsistencies of the information within the tax documents were very glaring. Which allowed us to pause on those particular applications. And then there's a couple other instances, suspected document alteration. We've noticed many, a few applicants who in round one, for example, would use the same ID but just with different pictures. And, you know, obviously the height, the weight, the eye color, but you could tell that this was the same exact identification. And so those are some of the instances. And what we've done with those instances, we have shared those with Deed. Those were deemed ineligible, highly suspicious, and unverifiable. And we packaged those applications into a document and shared those with Deed.
Thank you. And so Deed has those copies now. Were they ever shared with law enforcement from your operation?
No, sir. We've not been asked to do that by Deed. That is not part of our guidance from Deed.
Okay. Again, these are the 1040 U.S. forms that you normally look for business applications should have this in there, but you're noticing things were very duplicative. They're cut and pasting and making that happen, and I think that is why you're you all are trusted members of this deployment of these funds. So, again, you're stopping a lot of it, maybe not all of it. We don't exactly know, but I'm sure you're doing a very good job on this. But those are good indicators, and we'll get back to that about how we should move forward with identifying those people looking for money and not in a legitimate way. So that's kind of what we're trying to find out here today. Thank you very much for that. I think that's all I have
Chair.
For you. Yes. Let's go to Mita. Let's talk about the loans for a minute, and then I'm going to switch over to the Initiative Foundation. Welcome, and please introduce yourself and continue.
Yes, good morning. I am Adrian Ruddock. I'm Vice President of Lending and Business Consulting for MEDA. Thank you so much for having us, and we are happy to outline the loan program. So for our organization, the loan program functions a little bit differently than the grant. The loans are completely underwritten from a standpoint from a bank grade aspect. I've been a lender on the nonprofit and lending side for 25 years. And kind of really design MEDA's underwriting to function like a bank. We function, though we are a nonprofit, we function just like a bank. And so from that standpoint, I'll just go through some of the numbers here, and then I'll go back to our underwriting process and how we go about vetting clients and all clients, including Promise Act, to verify who they are and that they have the cash flow and that they're legitimately in business and they can pay us back. So on this document, I don't know what you have in front of you. I'll just kind of run through some of the details. And just to start, the Promise Act was kind of brought to us, and so we spent 6 months of preparation to do those, including what we needed to do was geo-target. Since the Promise Act is a geography-based lending, not racial, but geography, we spent 6 months geo-targeting. So our applications were restructured. We work with our IT department. So every loan that came in from a Promise Act had to be in the location. If it's not, then it's not moved forward. We use other programs for that standpoint. So that was very important from that aspect, just to clarify that. And then over the time, as you can see this report, we kind of really now broken down all of the information that we have on the Promise Act based on who applied, ethnicity, location, amounts. And so this document kind of really goes through that aspect. I'll just touch on some of the highlights. And so during the program, we have over 2,000 applications, and on the front page, you see the ethnicity is broken down across that aspect of it.
Mr. Ruddock, just a quick question. Are you referring to a form that everybody should have?
Yes, you should. We sent this over to it.
Thank you. Okay.
Don't. Please let me know.
Oh, thank you. We got it now. Thank you.
Oh, right. I apologize. I just want to make sure that you're on the right document. It looks like this on the Promise Act statistics. That's one of them. Those are the case studies. There are two. Oh. No, that's fine. I just want to just refer some of these pages. I won't go through everything. But we provide a report like this to DEED every quarter from this standpoint, how many applications, the breakdown, locations, reasons why. So I want to touch on this page here. It looks like this. And it shows total of a non-eligible applicants by reason. And so you see almost 1,000 are not in the Promise Act area, so you have to be geographically there. If your revenues are above the amount, then you can apply. And there's not enough years in business, so you would have to be in business for 2 years. And so this is a kind of a breakdown of that aspect. And as we go through, since committee members may not have had a chance to go through, it's just a breakdown of the data, applications, who applied, where they applied from, and then I just want to talk about the pipeline that we have at this point. We've deployed 19 loans for a little bit over $6.5 million, and then from that standpoint, we have about 7 loans in the pipeline currently right now for about $7.2 million. I will talk about our underwriting process because, again, I think that's really important to give some credence and some comfort to you as we vet all clients, including Promise Act. So if you apply, this is commercial real estate. This is not for working capital. So if you apply, we go through the process. We get IDs and everything. It's just like you would go to the bank. Then we run something nationally called CAVERS. And so CAVERS is, from a standpoint, it checks everywhere in the country if you have lawsuits, bankruptcies, fraud, anything like that. If you are caught there, then the loan is denied at that point. So there's a no-go from there. Then we collect bank statements, business bank statements, personal, run your credit, and do everything else from a standard bank. Any bankers are in the room would understand from that standpoint. Then we underwrite the loan. We go from an analytical standpoint to make sure the business has enough cash flow and the asset itself. So we'll do an appraisal on the building, and we do a physical an inspection. So we have members on our team that will do both an appraisal and an inspection just to make sure that the real estate asset is valuable, and at the same time that the loan to value, that we're not overlending on the value of the property. Then we take that to our loan committee, go through that process, and then once that's kind of really approved by our loan committee, then the loan is closed at a title company because it's real estate. So along that process, it's very difficult for someone to misrepresent themselves as the owner of the property itself, the business's cash flow, their ability to repay. And so we've gone through that aspect. That's for all loans that we ever do, including Promise Act. So we just added the Promise Act as part of our traditional underwriting process from that standpoint. And I'll leave it from there from the standpoint. I know some of you did not get a chance to go through all of these. But again, from that, our objective is to make sure that we are stewards of the finances that we receive, and we take great diligence to make sure that the money is deployed and that we can get it back and then we can redeploy it. And so that's a very important aspect for our standpoint. Again, 19 loans out the door. We can account for every penny, for every client, and for where they've gone, and for where we go through until we deploy all of the funds.
Thank you, Mr. Ruddock, very much. Have you stand by for now if we have any questions in a few minutes, okay? So thank you so much. Appreciate that.
Sure, thank you. More than happy to help.
Let's switch over to Mr. Scott Marquardt from this SWIF, if I could say that, the Southwest Initiative Foundation. Mr. Marquardt, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Marquardt. I'm president of Southwest Initiative Foundation. We're one of the six Minnesota Initiative Foundations. We serve the 18 counties, Upper Sioux Community and Lower Sioux Community of Southwest Minnesota. Our larger communities, just for geographic point of representation, would be Marshall, Wilmer, Worthington, and Hutchinson. 2026 is our 40th anniversary of the Initiative Foundation, so I do want to take 10 seconds and thank this committee and the members of it, both urban and rural. This is my 18th year at SWIFT and my 25th year doing economic development in Southwest Minnesota. And but for this committee, your counterpart in the Senate, the agency, a lot of good stuff, a lot of critical community need businesses would not be happening. So we are very grateful, and we are very grateful for the trust that this committee has put into us to manage these programs going forward. There's been a lot of conversation about process. Mr. Chair, I'll try not to be duplicative. We have not launched our round two Promise Act grants, so my frame of reference will be round one entirely. For our 18 counties, we had 292 total applications. We awarded 41, so then 212 were denied, and 39 were deemed ineligible through the rigor process that went in. So we had over $6.7 million of applications received. There is a high need for capital in this space. I would like to put a point, because this committee works with intermediaries and other things. In our 40th year at Southwest, this is our highest mathematical demand and deployment for loans ever in our history, to the point that we're even kind of pumping the brakes on a couple of things. I don't say that as a point to brag or of panic, but to show that entrepreneurs are investing in their businesses. Some pent-up demand from the pandemic is coming out. Critical community needs succession. We have a lot of 2- and 3-digit population communities. This program has worked in those, and that's just huge context I wanted to lift up. I also want to say, members of the committee, we had a lot of lessons learned from all of the pandemic programs that have formed this: small business emergency loans, loan guarantees, small business relief grants, Main Street COVID relief grants, Main Street economic revitalization, all of the alphabet soup. We touched those. Every one of those programs had demonstrable and significant impact in our region, and it taught us a lot about fraud prevention, about rigor, about things. Legislative intent and public purpose is paramount, because if we don't honor that, we know we will lose the trust of this committee and the agency and the administration. I also know that every dollar that goes to a business that's not eligible is a dollar that's taken from one of my businesses that is eligible and is within the bullseye of the statutory intent. It's also important, so we are grateful for any technical assistance support, that folks do not fall through the cracks. As we try to streamline and have things uploadable, we know that folks do not have digital literacy, access to broadband. So you might have to meet somebody in the Burger King parking lot at 10 o'clock at night to pick something up, because we want to lead with not letting someone fall through the cracks, managing what it means to maybe take a picture of a tax return with a, you know, a crummy cell phone camera. You figure that out, and you figure out how to do that and balance kindness and decency and humility with also the rigor that is needed in that specific place. One of the things I do want to lift up, Mr. Chair, is that I know there's been a lot of conversation about type of business. As we look at our data of applicants, we believe the type of applicants by business structure mirrors what we've seen in 40 years of economic development lending. Nearly 60% were limited liability companies, Minnesota business corporations, or limited partnerships. About 6% or so were nonprofits, and then roughly mathematically almost a third were sole proprietorships. And obviously, the committee doesn't need a tutorial on sole proprietorships. We take that very seriously from the other programs that were going forward. So if somebody's doing business as their name, you know, John Smith Plumbing or John Smith, we know they might not be registered, so we use other rigor. However, if it's Main Street Plumbing, is their assumed name in place? And then we layer in rigor afterwards. At the application stage, at the grant agreement stage, and prior to disbursement, the rigor was done case by case. If it didn't feel right, the caution flag went up and we paused. We relied on our partners to help us. Hey, is business X still here? Sometimes you do old school things like, you know, looking at the documents. As my friend from NDC was talking about, if it looks altered, if it looks funky, we know AI is out there. We know there's a lot of things working against us. If they're silent or ghosted, you know, on Facebook or on websites and they don't have a physical presence, it doesn't mean we automatically toss them. It means we go deeper. From the first programs from the pandemic, we know people, eligible, great people, didn't get funding because they met some criteria or something fell through the cracks. So we wanted to make sure applicants were given the right amount of time, but not at the expense of the prudence and the rigor to make sure that somebody who shouldn't be getting the money didn't. I stand by our data. I stand by what we did and can say that, you know, we look at these folks, a lot of them we know, and if we didn't know them, we relied on our partners or systems to be able to help verify related to that. There's a couple of things I would like to share just as feedback to the committee. As you think about these types of projects going forward, what saved us a lot of headache, and I think what helped especially rural businesses, and I think we learned a lot, all of us, from the pandemic programs, giving as much discretion, I'll use that word very carefully, discretion to the agency and to us while managing statutory intent. You can't legislate, as you know, for every scenario, but two key examples. Home-based businesses, we know that's a lot of conversation. In rural, that may mean the hair salon, the barn wedding venue on the home quarter. It may mean childcare. In a lot of rural areas, like contractors, excavators, electricians, major employers with great living wage jobs, they probably have their stuff at the home quarter or on their property. They may or may not have a separate address, but we can verify with certainty that, yeah, that's a plumber and that's $10 million worth of equipment that's there. So giving the discretion that they wouldn't fall through the cracks because of, you know, some address regulation. Thank you. Also, again, trying not to get into the weeds, but like all of us, and I'm sure my friends from Greater Minnesota will talk about this, Schedule F and ag businesses. Some of the programs have allowed for farmers, some have not. We worked with Schedule F farm tax returns for Promise Act. Some of the applicants may have multiple Schedule Fs based upon the type of what they do. Giving us the discretion to work with the department to layer statutory intent with what they're really doing to make sure somebody doesn't get tossed on a technicality. We are grateful for that because, you know, many of us are not full-time CPAs. We don't have CPAs on retainer at $300 an hour to help us. We have to do the best we can, and we work through those things to make sure they're not tossed. So I just, Mr. Chair, wanted to lift up that level of rigor is very personalized, but with statutory intent always being the shadow in the room. A couple of comments on loans, and I know we have other testifiers. We've put out $745,000 so far. We are fully committed. I mean, we're not actively promoting because we've got plenty of loans in the pipelines from our largest community down to three-digit populations, doing everything great from health and wellness to animal product meat processing to prepackaged meals, critical community need, health and wellness services, and stuff in between. And the stuff in the pipeline is also critical community need. Those have a lot of touch, as my friend to my left talked about, with site visits and inspections, and those are very relational, as any type of loan is, because, again, we want to make sure the capital gets in the hands of people that are doing it. Thank you. Before I close, thank you to this committee, to the Senate, for hearing the feedback about the tweaks that we could make to the loan program, about amortization length, about when the business has started. I can tell you those appropriate tweaks got some of our funded projects over the finish line that stayed well within statutory intent and allowed us to work with them. It means a lot to us when you hear our feedback, and we look forward to that again. I look forward to any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Marquardt. Let's go over to maybe just real quick before I let you go. As I mentioned, over to the NDC partners, you have also some of those suspected fraudulent ones, and you pass those on to Dee just like NDC does.
I can't say with certainty all were passed on. There's a couple of them. We did talk with them, but we did not reach out to law enforcement either, but
you
we have that info.
Okay, thank you.
We've retained it all.
Thank you for that. I'd like to call up Mr. Greg Wegner online, please. Greg, if you could take a few minutes. Again, I apologize for trying to push it along a little bit. We're running a little short on time. If you could give us an overview of something maybe that hasn't been said, or just kind of reiterate what you are working on as well with your folks up in the West Central Initiative Foundation. So welcome, Mr. Wegner. Introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Baker and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you this morning. My name is Greg Wegner. I am the Director of Business and Economic Development with West Central Initiative. We serve the nine counties of West Central Minnesota as one of the Minnesota Initiative Foundations, and including the White Earth Nation. So as Scott had indicated, our kind of larger communities are Moorhead, Fergus Falls, Detroit Lakes, Morris, and Alexandria. I can say a lot was covered by Scott, so I can really cut my comments short. I will talk about kind of our first round of Promise Act, and then roll into where we're at on our second round, and then touch on a little bit on the Promise Act loan program that we are also administering. We had 451 applications in the first round. 173 of those applications met those priority preferences that Deputy Commissioner McKinnon had identified. So they had the financial loss and had not received a lot of financial support previously from the state of Minnesota. We had to turn to the designed randomized selection process and were able to make 52 awards to businesses in the region throughout our counties. And all businesses had received their funding via checks. We chose to mail checks. They had received those by October of 2024. The other initiative foundations, we are pretty much on the same timelines for round one. We all launched and pretty much closed at the same time that application window. We were a little more staggered with the 2025 round. West Central Initiative opened ours on December 1st for applications and closed our application window on January 15th. We received 357 applications and are currently still reviewing and doing our initial cursory reviews of those applications. I can already tell this committee that we have again exceeded demand above our capacity to fund, and so we'll likely have to go to that randomized selection again for recourse. We have flagged 11 applications thus far that don't appear just right, and similar to the comments from NDC and from Scott at SWIFT, there is rigor and due diligence, and it's helpful that the volume of applications that the initiative foundations, especially us, have received is we know a lot of these people, and so we want to be extra careful with this funding and the trust that's been put in us by the legislature and the citizens of the state to deliver these programs effectively and as avoiding any fraudulent application funding as much as possible. And so our due diligence is very precise, I would say. And so we've flagged 11 for suspected not existing. That is down from what we saw in the first round, but I would say that the design of the applications is the fabricated applications is more sophisticated this round. Review has taken a little bit more additional time. And then probably to preempt a question, of course, we're kind of midstream in our review, so we have not forwarded any of these to DEED, nor have we reported anything to law enforcement. Obviously, if that becomes a request, we will obviously comply and turn over all that information that we have related to those applications that we identify are truly fraudulent or fabricated. And then just jumping to the Promise Loan Program, the Promise Loan Program has been a little slower start for us. We did wait for those legislative changes really to promote that. So we've funded about a third of our allocation of dollars to date. We have two loans that were not reported that we have not closed yet, but we have set aside dollars committed for those projects that will begin in the spring, and how our application process works. And I'm not speaking fully for the rest of our MIF partners, but we have basically a suite of funding programs that folks don't necessarily apply directly to the Promise Act for. They will apply for a general loan program, and we will fit it into the best program that that fits that particular project. And kind of one thing I want to note is a lot of our funding, especially on construction or site improvement projects, which is the focus of those promise loans, exceed our capacity as a sole lender. So we are working with bank partners and serving in a gap funding capacity where the bank isn't able to fund the full loan, and equity available to that business might not fully fill that remaining loan to value need. And so we're coming in with a smaller gap loan behind the bank and using those promise loan dollars. So we kind of have an extra level of due diligence where our traditional lenders are also reviewing those loans as well. I will actually pause there if there's any questions.
Yep, that'd be it. Thank you, Mr. Wagner. Thank you, Mr. Wagner, for that. My one quick question before I let you go is, what was your questionable applications in round one? I know you said there was 11 in round two. What was in round one?
We had 22 applications in round one that were identified as questionable, I guess.
And, thank you for being here today, too. Thank you. Zach Tabbitt from the Central Minnesota Initiative Foundation, if you could please unmute yourself and come online, introduce yourself, and proceed as briefly as you can, please. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As noted, I'm Zach Tabbitt, Vice President for Economic Opportunity at the Initiative Foundation. We are the Central Minnesota Initiative Foundation, serving the 14 counties and two Native nations located directly north of the 7-county metro. I'll keep my comments very high level for you all. Mr. Marquardt and Wagner and Shahir from NDC all hit many of the points that I was intending to hit. As noted by Mr. McKinnon, our team has completed the award allocations for the grant program so far. So examples of the communities where grants were made include St. Cloud, Melrose, Brainerd, Becker, Piers, Mora, Big Lake, and many others. The team's also been deploying our Promise Act loan program. This activity is ongoing in real time. We are approaching our full allocation of lending. We have made 12 total loans so far and estimate that these loans have helped create 22 new full-time and 12 new part-time jobs while supporting 6 existing full and 6 existing part-time jobs at the businesses that have received loans through the program. We also estimate nearly $900,000 in additional private investments have been leveraged through the capital stacks for the projects we've been involved with. As Greg just noted, we're often involved in gap lending with banks, so that is part of the private leverage involved there. Throughout this process, the Initiative Foundation has served as a regional administrator for that grant program for Central Minnesota, consistent with all deed requirements. The foundation performed all the specific due diligence required by deed for the regional partners throughout for every applicant and submitted those award recommendations that were then approved by deed before funds were released. We were designated specifically in the Promise Act statute as a regional partner, and we're proud to have been delivering economic development programs in Central Minnesota in partnership with the state and legislature for the last 40 years. As Scott referenced, we are now celebrating our 40th anniversary. I'll leave it at that for now, since I know we're running short on time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate your testimony today, Mr. Tabbitt, and to all the testifiers today, thank you. I think, again, you've done a very good job in dealing with a lot of dollars going through your operations in a very good manner. I think what we want to do is to make sure that with what we're dealing with here in Minnesota, with the cloud of fraud that we're all trying to make sure is being managed as minimally as possible through our committee, is that we've got good partners like yourselves watching our footprints as best we can and as tightly as we can. Thank you for all of that very much. I think, again, I also want to note to the members in the packet, we have a Northwest Minnesota Foundation in here too. The director couldn't be here today too, but I wanted to just make sure that Northwest Minnesota Foundation also has a document in here too to do that. I'm going to maybe ask Dee to come back up now at this time. So you guys can actually take a step back. I think at this point, if we have questions for you individually, we'll let you know. But I think that that covered a lot of it for us. With that, I've got a few members that have questions. I've got maybe a question, too, just to kind of kick this off with a little bit here. Mr. McKinnon, thank you for coming back to the table. We heard a number of times, again, and through some of the questions that I was asking, and I learned about this when I was kind of preparing for today's meeting. And also just for folks out there wanting to know, the list that all the grantees are and where they were awarded are online. It's public information. You can go online to see who the grantee award winners are on both the NDC side and also the Initiative Foundations. It's all very transparent. When I was looking at that list initially, too, Deputy Commissioner, there's a lot of information kind of missing on a lot of those businesses online. There's no NAICS code, which is sort of the industry code. What industry do they represent? They may be a lot of just sole proprietors that have an individual name. It's not Pete's Plumbing, but there's a lot of information about where the location is. And so can you help me understand just why is some information missing from a lot of those online that I assume was vetted by our partners, and is it just clerical? Why isn't that on the list, Mr. McKinnon?
Mr. Chair, the awards that are posted on the website, obviously this is in preparation for our March 15th report that's coming to you. I believe all of that information will be eventually there. We do not have it for all of the organizations who have made awards. So I think on the website you will see blanks in certain areas, and I believe that's the reason why.
So to that, again, I guess I'm just surprised that I understand the report is coming. But if you're posting something online with the amount that was awarded, the name of the company or the sole proprietor, and there's a lot of information missing, why would it even be up there in the first place? So that would be something that I look forward to hearing from you later. My final question is, and then I'll turn it over to members. Again, we've heard of the rigor and the awareness that some tax forms, some applications have looked very suspicious. They've passed those on to you with their packets. And again, I want to know, what is our plan? What is Deed's authority? Do you think those that are trying to take money from us in what appears to be a very shaky and a very careless way of taking taxpayer dollars, do you think we should be turning those over to law enforcement officials to identify who are they, what are they doing, are they infiltrating other areas of the state agencies somewhere? What can Deed do to make sure when these rise to the top of high suspicion, what does Deed do with those at this time?
Mr. Chair and members, in the case of some of these applications that look suspicious, we they're sent to us, we would look at that, try to determine, you know, is it fraud, is it some other reason to investigate? And if that is true, then our role at in my division within the agency is then we escalate it within our agency to our internal auditor, to our legal, and then there's a decision from there that's essentially made to send it to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, BCA.
And Mr. McKinnon, to your knowledge then, with all these applications that have been processed and sent up to you, and the numbers, I'm guessing between all of them, maybe 50, 60 or so that we know of that were passed on, just a rough number, has anybody been sought after legally at this point to your knowledge?
From those that have been sent to us, not to my knowledge.
So zero at this point. Again,
not to my knowledge.
Not to your knowledge. That is something that will be in the report, Mr. McKinnon?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if that's in the report, but I will certainly ask the question, and if it can be in the report, that would be great.
Okay. Bottom line is, I think that if we as legislators and our partners that are loaning out these dollars have got rigor built in. And if we've got people trying to get in the door and we are catching them because of good information and good rigor in the folks that are working the system, and they're handing us over potential fraudulent documents, it would be a gross mistake for the state of Minnesota to not be pursuing those, cross-referencing names, the businesses, the addresses, and how they relate to the massive fraud going on here in Minnesota. So that is, to me, the moment that we need to make sure we're doing everything we can as public officials, state employees, to insist that those are all being followed up on in a manner that will make sure these kinds of programs that help businesses going forward don't get blown up, don't get ruined because of some people that are, again, I use this analogy this morning. It's like having somebody come to my front door and my Ring camera picks them up and they're trying to get in my door and the door's locked. Thank goodness. And they walk away. But they keep doing this, or it's different people. At some point, I'm going to let the police officer know what's going on. And if I just ignore it, and it appears that we're not following up on this, in my opinion, at this time, we can't just ignore this any longer. So we need to have even higher rigor when we have identified fraudsters that are looking to manipulate 1040 forms and business forms. If they're trying to come at taxpayer dollars, I expect our agency to be really at a high level going after those people with all, everything we got. With that, I'm going to switch over to Representative Schultz for your first question.
Well, Mr. Chair, you were on a roll, and I see Chair Pinto was with you on that, so I'll just align myself with your remarks, because as it relates to fraud prevention in our state, one of the concerns that we have heard in the fraud committee is that our state agencies have not been appropriately or effectively, maybe effectively, communicating the individuals who have tried to commit fraud against our state government and its agencies and its programs. And so if we're desiring to ensure that dollars are flowing to the people which these dollars were intended to, we need to protect them from the fraudsters. And we know, based upon what has been seen in Minnesota, this has been a industrial-scale fraud ring. And what that means for all of us and for this conversation is the people who could be potentially identified here are quite likely to be the same people who are found in other programs, potentially, directly impacting our Medicaid dollars. And when we consider as a legislature for this session and to our Ways and Means co-chair, when we're considering the things that we need to do to get our error rates down from the federal government because of H.R. 1 last year and the fraud rates, these are things that are incredibly important to us. So I appreciate your comments there. So let me just turn to you, Deputy Commissioner, then and seek to understand here. KSTP reported that the Housing Care Incorporated received a $33,500 award and but had also billed Medicaid $4 million going back to 2023. How did this business fall under the $750,000 revenue limit?
Mr. McKinnon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz, this housing care applied in 2024 using their 2023 business tax filings, which would have been their most recently completed tax year that is part of the law. And based on the program's income threshold levels, this business would have received an amount commensurate with their revenue reported from the 2023 tax return.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll mention this general concern that one of the things that we're seeing in the way that our Medicaid-funded programs are being defrauded is that in one instance, you have a business set up at a given site. They are charged with and potentially closed due to things related to fraud, shut down one day, restarted and opened the next day under a new name at the same site, providing the same service, also billing Medicaid. So, for your agency, I want you to be very cognizant of that, because if this program is meant to continue, under its current guise, I'm concerned with how this could play itself out. That same question then, a similar question would be in regards to the B&M Vital Home Care, which KSDP reported on as well, which received $47,000 but had their license with the state revoked for client safety before the grant window opened. Tell me about that one. Is there a concern with that application and the approach to that?
Deputy Commissioner Dollars.
Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz, the organization's grant was awarded in September of 2024. Its eligibility and the grant amount was based on the 2023 revenue that they had submitted. Public records do show that DHS took action against this organization sometime in earlier in 2024, I believe it was April. During that time frame, the business appealed, and during the appeal timeline, apparently the business continued to operate until it was officially revoked, I believe around the same time in 2025, April of 2025.
Representative Schultz, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'd just like to go to here is just to actually understand how this model was chosen. And one of the concerns, and this is for the legislature too, is I've gone back to look at the details around this Promise Act program, and quite honestly, to the members in this body, there was no legislation introduced prior to committee deadlines in 2023. Meaning that this was never vetted in committee. This is a $100 million program. Members, Explore Minnesota has a biennial budget of $33 million. This program received $100 million and didn't receive the vetting from the legislature. That's in the House or the Senate. Literally, that didn't follow our own rules. Dollars started appearing after committee deadlines on April 11th of 2023. But where were the standards? How's the public supposed to trust this program and the rollout model which was chosen? I'm wondering here, that was passed in 2023. Right now, we're in March of 2026, and we see that there's $72 million. Is that the number that I heard today? That's still in here? I can't tell you that this is an effective use of dollars. $8 million for administration. I'm just shocked by this. If the goal was to get this out to help people, I'm really seeing that government has failed in this regard, in addition to the concerns that we have about fraud and waste. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
In your question, thank you very much. Representative Seleznikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. My question is around when the program was started. It looks to me that it's about 18% was allocated to Greater Minnesota. I'd like to understand how that number was reached, because when I look at the criteria, structural racial discrimination, civil unrest, lack of access to capital, loss of population, aging population, lack of regional economic diversification. Greater Minnesota has a solid 4 of the 6. And so when you're coming out of this pandemic and you have over 90% of the businesses are small businesses in Greater Minnesota, my question is, how was that 18% allocation selected? Because currently, there's equal aging population. There's 510,000 aging seniors in Greater Minnesota, and there's 511,000 in the metro suburbs. We're basically the same. So I would like to have more information on this, please.
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Seleznikar, we don't assign the appropriations. We didn't choose which region got which amount of money. I think what I would say as far as our agency is concerned, and in my history of working at the agency, we recognize and appreciate everything that you just brought up. And we have worked through various programs with the legislature, et cetera, to ensure that funds are going to address those issues in greater Minnesota. So I can't give you the reason why it was $16 million versus $76 million or whatever the number is for the metro area, but that's something that you as the legislature decide and appropriate to us.
Mr. McKinnon, before I give it back to Rep. Salznikar, weren't you there, though, to help draft this language for this bill to help the legislators at that time?
Mr. Chair, yes, there was, as if you recall, there was a lot of language that was going through the legislature at that time, a lot of new programs, et cetera. And so to the extent that we could contribute to it, does the legislature take all of our advice all the time? The answer is no, which we appreciate, and it's part of the process. So were we there? And I believe our history and how we have interacted with Greater Minnesota over the years would probably indicate that, of course, we bring it up.
Again, just what was concerning here, and again, Representative Schultz brought it up too, that we didn't have that same vetting through that process that year. And again, a lot of this took place after committee deadlines in conference, and that's where the smaller bills that had been dragged along or to talk about some of the relief needed in some very smaller areas, very specific, completely changed in the conference committee. So I'm sorry, back to Representative Salznikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that information. I sat on the committee in 23, and I don't remember any conversation. And I represent the largest county in the state, St. Louis County. I also represent Lake County. And to see that we have $72 million still sitting on the table when we have non-emergency transportation issues, we have critical accesses hospitals in jeopardy, we have seniors and programs in jeopardy, to me, I think that needs to be answered. And if not you, indeed, who made that determination where Greater Minnesota is completely been left out in this formula in the degree I believe it should have been considered with the criteria that was set when four pillars meet the conditions for Greater Minnesota?
Thank you. And again, I think that there are a number of dollars still yet unencumbered in this program, Representative, so we can also, as legislators, look at this and look at what the future looks like, too. So next is up is Representative Wayne Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Chair Baker. Question I have is maybe a follow-up on some of this. Thank you for the presentation. Was the you mentioned that prior year the one company had sales underneath the criteria and then the next year. The process for seeing if they qualify and if they're underneath that, are you seeing financial statements and bank statements and then ways to prove that they're actually underneath that 750?
Deputy Commissioner? Or yeah, NDCs can come up here. Mr. Ahmed.
Thank you, Chair. We use 2 years of taxes, and that helps us determine the year-over-year loss that is described in the law.
Okay. Thank you. I have a few questions.
Representative Johnson.
So then the other question I had was, one of the other questions is, and maybe I missed it in here, but there isn't, if I read correctly, you haven't been going back yet and seeing if the money has been used for that purposes because you don't have enough ability to do that. Is that correct?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, as of now, we have not gone back. As I mentioned, we do reserve the right to do that. We will be doing that on our random samplings or that we get. We have not instructed the partners to go and collect that information as of yet. So that's the answer to your question.
Representative Wayne Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the timeline on that? I've seen other grants, when they've been given out, they're expected to be able to prove that they used the money for the purposes that they received that. I'm just wondering why it wasn't set up for this and why that's not happening yet.
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, that has been discussed and has been talked about. It was not set up originally as part of this, as it was, as I mentioned earlier, it was sort of modeled after what some of the relief programs were created during the pandemic. So those are things that now that round one is closed and we are at that point, that we do reserve the right to go back and do and will do.
Rep. Johnson, follow up.
Yes, that concerns me just because you're granting money for what businesses say they want to use it for, need it for, but there's no checks and balances as of right now to do that. That's a little concerning. Another one is the loan program and starting a business and buying a business and going through the SBA program. And basically when you do that, you sign over your whole life, you know, basically, and every day you live in fear that you're going to lose your house. So with this program, what type of collateral is promised? Is there a default rate yet? And is there plans that you'd actually go back and try to collect on those loans?
Deputy Commissioner, do you want to take that, or should we have Mr. Raddick back to the table?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Raddick, would you please come forward, please?
And I do actually have one additional thing to say to your previous question.
Sure. Okay. We'll have Mr. Raddick go first about the loan default and follow-up. Thank you. Welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself again.
Specifically, I'll address the collateral aspect of it. So the property has to appraise way above. We use it in an aspect of, let's say it's $1 million. The loan has to be about $750,000. So there's some equity. So if they do default, we can collect the rest of the loan from there. They also sign a personal guarantee, and any other assets that they have are also part of the collateral aspect of it. So there is three layers from that standpoint: the property, their personal guarantee, and that they have a home with some equity or anything else, those are taken along with the loan.
Okay, thank you. I just have one.
Yeah, one follow-up and then I'll move on.
Thank you. I just have a quick thing. So I find it interesting that one of the program challenges was for people to apply was the time required to complete an application is a significant hurdle for businesses already struggling to stay staffed and keep their doors open. So the reason I bring that up is I find it interesting that we spend 75% of our time down here at the Capitol creating obstacles and making it more difficult for businesses to stay open. And then we spend another 25% of coming up with funding and grants to help those businesses that are struggling to stay open. I think we need to start thinking about changing that around. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, or Rep. Johnson. Representative Mueller, and then on to Representative Pete Johnson. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for being here for this presentation. I had the pleasure of being able to tour NDC and see the work that they do, and was so impressed with the things that they, with what they are able to do with the small amount of people that work there. And also have had the privilege of working with SMIF as well and in my area. So when I hear them tell me that they are doing everything they can with the short amount of staff that they have to go through thousands of applications and trying to make sure that they are finding trends and patterns of fraud, were you as Deed giving them any guidance on how to prevent fraud? And what were they expected to do with them once they found them? How were they expected to weed it out? Did you offer any training, any guidance, anything to help them since they pretty much put their neck out for you and did the bulk of the information vetting for you?
Chair. Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mueller, the design of the program was initially through them, and they were obviously legislatively named through the process. That being said, yes, that took us months, as we discussed earlier, to talk through some of that guidance, some of those types of things. Have we and did we talk about fraud, waste, abuse, et cetera, during those conversations? I am probably 100% sure that we did. I was not in those initial meetings. In any of the meetings that I've been in the 3 years, have I talked about it with them? Absolutely, I have. And so to the extent of what guidance that we could have provided them, I'm sure we did, but I can't give that to you off the top of my head because I wasn't there. But I could ask some of the folks who may have been there at those presentations, Mr. Chair.
Sure, real briefly, please.
Mr. Chair, sir. And Member Mueller, we have received from third parties training and for fraud awareness, for readiness and response trainings as well. And as Mr. McKinnon has mentioned, in all of our meetings with Deed that we have standing meetings, we are discussing how to identify and how to best mitigate what we are finding.
Representative Mueller, any follow-up? All right, thank you very much. Representative Pete Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. First, thank you to the organizations that came and talked about the work that they're doing in their communities. I know that this is something that's really important and really appreciate the scrutiny that you guys have given it and the seriousness that you've taken in managing taxpayer dollars. You know, and to kind of follow up on Rep. Wayne Johnson's point of like checks and balances, ensuring that they're doing the things that they say that they're doing. And with this Promise Act, the max is $50,000 that an employee, a business can receive. Do we have any checks and balances to do that same thing, ensure that companies are doing what they say they're going to do with a lot of the massive tax breaks that different corporations get or the subsidies that they get to bring businesses in to ensure that they're doing what they're saying that they're going to do, or is this scrutiny only applied to these smaller businesses?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, the Promise Act is obviously a separate piece of legislation relative to some of the other programs. I'll talk about some of the other programs in a minute and what we do. But the Promise Act was not designed as a reimbursable program or a match program where businesses have to demonstrate that in order to get it. The other piece that I would just tell you is these grantees have 12 months in which to spend the award, and so we're almost in that 12-month period at this time. So that I hope answers the first part of your question. The second part of your question relates to larger companies, larger agreements. We have a whole separate way that we deal with those types of companies that receive an amount of program assistance either through a forgivable loan or some type of some type of project like that, each one of those businesses would sign what's called a business subsidy agreement. In there is very specific goals and what happens if there is a default or something like that. So I can tell you with 100% certainty, do we go after those businesses that default or have problems in there? Absolutely. Do we chase them around the world? In fact, I have. Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. No, I appreciate that, and this broader conversation of looking at it for our public dollars and taxpayer dollars to make sure they're going what they're intended to do, and to make sure that we're not just focusing on, you know, smaller businesses like this, but we're focusing on those large businesses that also get a huge amount of our dollars sent to them. So thank you.
Thank you for that. Representative Akeberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the partner businesses. Thank you for Deed for coming in, or the partner organizations. It was encouraging to hear the thorough vetting that it seems that you guys are doing across the state to ensure that we're being good stewards of taxpayer dollars. One of the biggest questions that I have heard from constituents over the last few years is, what in the world happened to an $18 billion surplus? So, and if I'm understanding right, one of the things that we had $100 million put into this Promise Act, and $28 million is out the door in different types of, you know, through the program. So we have about $72 million on the bottom line still available, you know, roughly. Is that an accurate assessment of where the fund is at now?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Akeberg, that is accurate with the math that you're using for the grant program, and then on top of that is the loan program where there's another $20 million or something that has yet to be encumbered and out the door. Yep.
And I'm going to pull in here quick, just when the round two monies are certainly out to the MIFs right now or NDCs, those are not awarded directly yet, but they're encumbered to those agencies. So I would say roughly the number is a little closer to around $50 million is not encumbered at this point. Representative Akeberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You actually answered my next question, so thank you. You read my mind. I know we're running short on time, but yesterday in Education Finance, we talked about measuring and how oftentimes here in St. Paul we measure outcomes, and we often do that by measuring what we send out, and we don't evaluate effectiveness of it. And Representative Johnson was touching on that. So I would love in the report that you bring back, I know we have some stories, but trying to look at some longitudinal data of the effectiveness of this $120 million that has gone out through grants. Because, you know, Representative Zelenskar talked about senior care. We have huge needs across the state of Minnesota. One of them that I'm passionate about is school security. We need one-time dollars for school security grants to go out to keep our kids safe in schools. So if we can look at opportunities where money is not encumbered, we as committees, we as the legislature, should be looking at how do we effectively use taxpayer dollars. Because the number one question that I hear from constituents is, what in the world happened to that surplus? What happened to $18 billion? And what I heard today is that these partner organizations are doing a fantastic job of vetting the different grantees, but I'm hearing from the agency that there's lots of gaps. And that's a consistent pattern that needs to be addressed if we want to actually be serious about addressing fraud, waste, and abuse in Minnesota. It's not our partner organizations, it's our agencies across the board.
Thank you, Representative Akeberg. I think we'll just wrap it up, and I'll get it over to my co-chair here in a minute. Again, thank you, Deputy Commissioner, for coming up, and the agencies that were very helpful in getting this business support out. I think, again, as I'm hearing my colleagues reiterate what I was mentioning earlier, your steadfast guidance to small business is enormously helpful for everybody around Minnesota, downtown, Minneapolis, St. Paul, to the to the outer ring, to greater Minnesota. We are, and I heard this last night at our greater MSP event that both co-chair Pinto and I were at, it's community plus greater Minnesota. We are all one Minnesota here, and we have to work together on a lot of these kinds of things. Getting back to just the following up, I know we've got a report coming out in a couple weeks, or a little less than a couple weeks. I can't wait to see the report. I want to see the full detail of where these are with all the details, with all the award winnings. They should be listed quickly. I think we have to follow up on the outcomes. How do we do a better job following up on the outcomes? Are these businesses still open? Are they actively still surviving? Did they fail in the last 12 months? We need to know as much of this as we can to know that these programs are actually working. And then also we have to find out, why are we not taking the fraud more seriously? When we get something handed to us on a silver platter by the partners that we're asking to bring that to us, if we are not getting those to law enforcement sooner than later, I don't know what we're doing. That is a complete failure on our part, and I hope that that's going to be part of your either recommendations, Deputy Commissioner, or whatever that might be, but we can certainly have more follow-up of that in the future. So, again, this was an important meeting for us to have members because this was not vetted properly 2 years ago. When I sat on this committee, and this did not come up in any kind of scope of this at all. To my co-chair, Rep. Pinto, a little preview about tomorrow.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And I maybe will note that I know that this passed through the House at the same total amount of money, but name changed a number of things. I actually think it became more favorable to Greater Minnesota in conference, but further conversations we can have. Tomorrow we'll be having a presentation discussion on misclassification of workers, of employees as independent contractors in a way that doesn't just hurt workers, it actually hurts other employers through unfair competition, also taxpayers and government. Looking forward to the conversation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, everybody. That concludes our agenda for today. We are adjourned.